Module 9 is risk modeling. This covers chapter 9 in the textbook. So let's go ahead and get out our study sheet. And as you can see, we're going to be talking about various risk measures, including probability analysis and volatility. We'll also talk about different methods of risk modeling, such as trend analysis and analyzing event consequences. This is a fairly complex module for this course. We are going to have a few calculations and go through a few concepts that are somewhat advanced concepts. We'll start with probability analysis. We'll then talk about volatility, two concepts, value at risk and earnings at risk. We'll discuss trend analysis and analyzing event consequences. Let's start off, though, by talking about probability analysis. Risk professionals need to be able to estimate the likelihood that a loss will occur. Probability of an event is the likelihood that it will happen over a specific period of time. Risk professionals can use a probability analysis to predict the likelihood of an event. It's a technique for forecasting. Probability is the frequency an event can be expected to occur in a stable environment. Probabilities are an important part of loss exposure analysis. They can be expressed as a percentage, such as 50%. They could be also expressed as a decimal, such as 0.5, or a fraction, such as 1/2. All of those are acceptable. The lowest possible probability is 0%. The highest possible probability is 100%. Probability is affected by theoretical probability, empirical probability, and the law of large numbers. Let's talk about all three of those. We'll start by talking about theoretical probability. Theoretical probability is developed based on theoretical principles rather than actual experience. We don't need to look at past experience when we're dealing with theoretical probability. For example, if I have a coin, if I flip a coin, I know it's either going to be heads or tails, and there's a 50% probability of it being heads, a 50% probability of it being tails. I don't need to look at what's happened in the past to determine that, because it's a theoretical probability. Also, throwing dice is another example of theoretical probability. If I throw dice, that's two dice, the minimum value is going to be 2, the maximum value is going to be 12, and there's no other outliers. We can't have a 1 if we throw a pair of dice. We can't have a 13. It's going to be between 2 and 12. Theoretical probabilities are unchanging, and they are fixed probabilities, unlike something like life expectancy, which can change. Life expectancy is an empirical probability, which we'll talk about next. Theoretical probabilities are generally not applicable to insurance. Empirical probability is a probability based on actual experience. So for empirical probability, we are looking at past results. We're looking at past experience. It includes things like the probability of a 60-year-old individual dying. It only represents estimates, and their accuracy depends on the nature of the samples studied. Empirical probabilities change over time. For example, life expectancy will increase over time due to advances in medicine. Risk management professionals use empirical probabilities. We also need to know the law of large numbers for our exam. Very important concept. The law of large numbers states the inaccuracy between empirical frequency and theoretical probability decreases as the sample size increases. As the number of independent events increases, there's an increased chance that the actual results will be close to the expected results. What does all of that mean? Seems kind of confusing, but here's essentially what it's saying. We'll look at an example. Let's say that I have a coin, and we know that based on theoretical probabilities, there's a 50% chance of me getting heads. There's a 50% chance of it being tails, right? So it's 50-50, that's not going to change. However, let's say that I flip that coin twice and it just happens to come out as heads both times. That's something that could happen, right? Even though it's 50% chance of it being heads, I flip it twice and it's heads both times. But what we had there is the empirical frequency disagreed with the theoretical probability, didn't it? The law of large numbers says that the more I flip that coin, the more independent events that occur, the more likely that my empirical frequency is going to agree with the theoretical probability. So for example, if I flip that coin twice and I get heads both times, well, you know, that could happen. But if I flip that coin 10,000 times, what's likely to happen is I'm likely to have roughly 5,000 heads and 5,000 tails. The more I flip the coin, the more likely I am to eventually wind up at that theoretical expected probability. That's the law of large numbers. Probability analysis is best for organizations with substantial volume of data on past losses and stable operations. Forecasts of future losses are more reliable if the data sample is larger. In insurance, we need to use the law of large numbers. We need a lot of independent events to do an analysis. The law of large numbers is only effective if the events being forecast are independent of one another and numerous, have occurred in the past under substantially identical conditions, and expected to occur in the future under the same unchanging conditions. Let's highlight this. This can make a great question for your exam. A probability distribution is a table, chart, or graph depicting estimates of a set of circumstances. Both theoretical and empirical probabilities can be used to construct distribution tables. We actually have an example and a handout that we're going to go through in this module in just a few minutes that show examples of theoretical and empirical probability tables. Probability distributions can be either discrete or continuous. Discrete means there's a fixed number of outcomes. For example, if I toss a coin, it's either going to be heads or tails, that's it. Continuous means there can be an unlimited number of outcomes. For example, there could be a loss of 4,000, 10,000, 8 million, 20 million, just goes on and on and on. Outcomes must be mutually exclusive and collectively exhaustive. What does mutually exclusive mean? That means that only one outcome is possible with each given occurrence or event. For example, if I flip a coin, it's either going to be heads or tails on the first flip. It can't be both. They're mutually exclusive. It's going to be one or the other. If I roll a pair of dice, it's either going to be two, it's going to be three or four or five, all the way up to 12, but it could be nothing else. Can't have two results. It's just one result between two and 12. That's mutually exclusive. Collectively exhaustive means that all the possible outcomes are represented in our table. For example, if we had a table showing the different probability distribution for the roll of a pair of dice, we'd have one outcome being the number two, one outcome being the number three, all the way up to the outcome of 12, and that would be collectively exhaustive because 2 through 12 are the only possibilities. So let's talk about the two different probability distribution tables. The first one is a theoretical probability distribution table. Theoretical probability distribution tables are developed based on theoretical probabilities. These are not used much for insurance, but we're going to take a look at an example because it's important to understand this concept. Let's go ahead and get the handout that came with your study materials. It's called Probability Distribution Theoretical / Discrete. And if you notice, what we're showing on this probability distribution table is the probability of two dice being rolled. It starts off with the occurrence of two and works its way all the way up to 12. So once again, the lowest value that we could get is two because we have two dice, and each one can come up with a one, which is going to be a value of two. And of course, they could both be sixes, which means the highest value is 12, and we could have any combination in between. If you notice, we list in the middle column the number of occurrences. For example, rolling a two could only happen one way, if both dice are coming up one. Rolling a 12 can only happen one way, if both dice roll a six. And then we show the probability of each occurrence, if you notice. And of course, since this table is discrete, the probabilities do add up to 100% because we've taken into account all different occurrences that could occur. So let's take a look here. If two dice are rolled, one of the dice is blue and one is yellow, there are 36 equally likely outcomes. For example, the blue die could be 1 and the yellow die could be 1. The blue die could be 2 and the yellow die could be 1. The blue die could be 3, the yellow die could be 1. And we go all the way through and then start over again where the blue die is 1, the yellow die is 2. The blue die is 2, the yellow die is 2. If you add up all the different potential occurrences, there are 36 possibilities if we have two dice. There's a 1 in 36 probability of each outcome. One of those outcomes could be the blue die is a 5 and the yellow die is a 4. That's one outcome out of the 36. And there's a 6 in 36 probability of the total being 7. Where do we get 7 from? And six occurrences. We can have it a few different ways. For example, the blue die is a 1 and the yellow is a 6. Or the blue die is a 6 and the yellow is a 1. And it could be 2 or 5, 5 and 2, 3 and 4, 4 and 3. This is six different ways that we could come up with the number 7. And if you notice on our handout sheet, if you look at the total points, two dice, you notice it has 7 listed and there are 6 occurrences of that. So this is the probability distribution table. An empirical probability distribution table would be based on past experience. It's based also on looking at losses that have occurred over the years, putting them together, analyzing them. Loss categories, which are called bins, by the way, if you see that term, it's just different loss categories, must be designed to include all possible losses. Bins are arbitrarily defined values that may or may not be divided into equal sizes. The sum of the empirical probabilities must equal 1. The probability for each outcome must be defined. There's no evident upper limit in size category of losses. In other words, there is no maximum loss. And let's take a look. This hopefully will help explain all of this. If we look at that same handout sheet, we've got probability distribution, empirical slash continuous, that table at the bottom of the sheet. And if you notice now, what we're using as our bins is the size of loss. One of the bins is $0 to $4,000. $4,001 to $8,000 is a second bin. We have $8,001 to $12,000, $12,001 to $16,000. And then finally, we have $16,001 plus. Why do we have that plus after the $16,001? Well, that's because this is a continuous table, and therefore there is no upper limit. So we have to take into account all possibilities. So what we do is on the very last bin, we add the plus. So anything over $16,000 goes into that last bin. If you'll notice, all bins before that are exactly $4,000 increments, and that's great, but that's not always the case. As you probably remember, we said that bins are arbitrarily defined values that may or may not be divided into equal sizes. And so we have no evident upper limit. There's no maximum loss because we have 16,001 plus. And if you notice, the sum of the probabilities, the percentage of losses, that middle column, does equal 100%. It has to equal 1. So this is an example of an empirical probability chart. Probability distribution of physical damage to a home for a group of insured houses is another example of an empirical probability distribution table. Probably don't need to go through this in much detail, simply because we just went through an example of one for auto losses. But if you take a look here, here's just another way of doing it. For houses, let's say we have the size of loss, and now our bin is 0 to 10,000. There were 16 losses in that category, 10,000 to 20,000, 20 to 30, and then 30 or more. And it shows the number of losses and the percentage of losses. And as we expect, that does equal 100%. Just another example of an empirical probability table. We mentioned before discrete and continuous as well. Discrete probability distributions have a limited, countable number of possible outcomes, typically used as frequency distributions showing how often something will occur. For example, if you look at our top table in our handout, it is discrete. It shows what could result from throwing two dice, and the only possibilities are 2, 3, 4, all the way up to 12. That's it. Nothing else. Nothing greater, nothing less. That's a discrete table. Continuous probability distributions have an infinite number of possible outcomes, can be presented by dividing the distribution into a countable number of bins. And if you notice for the auto losses, what we did is we had four different bins of $4,000 each, 0 to 4, 4 to 8, and so forth. That last bin, to take into account the fact that this is continuous, we put the plus after the 16,001. Let's do a practice question. Which one of the following statements is correct regarding the nature of probability? A, probabilities are typically expressed graphically using a bar chart or pie chart. That's false. They're typically expressed numerically using a decimal, percentage, or fraction. So A is false. What about B? Theoretical probability is developed based on actual experience. That's false. That's empirical probability. C, empirical probabilities are only estimates whose accuracy depends on the size of the samples. C is correct. That's our answer. And D, theoretical probability is the type of probability most commonly used by risk management professionals. No, we said empirical probability is commonly used by risk management professionals. So C is our answer. Let's talk about the concept of volatility. Many organizations have the same risks, or at least similar risks, but some organizations experience far greater consequences than other organizations. The reason for this is volatility in the internal and external factors that affect a business. So let's discuss volatility. Volatility is the degree of variation a subject, such as risk, may have. Can vary significantly among industries. A subject that has higher volatility is more risky and more likely to be managed. Volatility can be analyzed using various metrics, and we're going to go through each one of these metrics, and this gets a little bit tricky. We're going to talk about the expected value or mean, standard deviation, the coefficient of variation, and a normal distribution. We actually have a handout for normal distribution. You may want to get that out now. We'll be going over that in a few minutes. It looks like a bell curve. So let's go through each one of these. It's very important that we're able to accurately determine volatility if we're a risk manager. The first concept is expected value, also known as the mean. The expected value is the weighted average of values. Weights are given to each value based on its likelihood of occurrence. It's the best guess for a risk management professional of what a future outcome will be. If a probability experiment were repeated numerous times, the expected value is the average of all the results. Sometimes the expected value or mean can be a very straightforward determination, a very straightforward calculation. For example, let's say that my investment over the last 4 years had a rate of return of 8%, 10%, 8%, and 10%, respectively. So 8, 10, 8, 10. If you take the average of that, the mean return or expected value is simply 9%. It's just a simple average. And we could do that as well with risks. For example, if we wanted to figure out the average or expected value of workers' compensation claims for the last 5 years, we would just add up all the workers' compensation claims for the last 5 years and divide by 5. That would give us an expected value, or a mean, as it's sometimes called. However, sometimes it could be a little more complicated when it's not always an equal weighting. For example, let's say that it costs $100 to enter a raffle, to buy one ticket, and a total of 10 tickets are going to be sold. That's $1,000. But the grand prize is a $1,200 value vacation. And so let's say that you buy one of those tickets. Well, you've got a 1 in 10 chance of winning the raffle, or a 10% chance of winning the raffle. If you win the raffle, what is your overall winning amount? It would be $1,100, wouldn't it? The $1,200 vacation that you won minus the $100 that you paid for the ticket. So in this case, you've got a 10% chance of winning a net amount of $1,100 because you paid $100 for the ticket. However, there's a 90% chance that you're going to buy that $100 ticket and win nothing. And so there's a 10% chance of an $1,100 win, and there's a 90% chance of a $100 loss. To calculate the expected value, what we can do is take the $1,100 win and multiply it by 10%, which is the probability, and that gives us $110. We can then take the $100 loss and multiply that by 90%, and that winds up being a negative $90. Now, if we net the two, $110 minus $90, that gives us $20. That's expected value of the raffle. And what we could do is we can compare that expected value of $20 to the expected value of entering other raffles to see which one might be the best choice. So that's expected value. There's a few ways that it can be calculated. Sometimes it's easy, sometimes not so easy. A second measure of risk or volatility is standard deviation. Standard deviation represents the magnitude of the dispersion of values from the mean or from the average. How much something differentiates from the mean? Is it a wide dispersion? Is it a narrow dispersion? That's standard deviation. Risk managers often use standard deviation during the analysis of loss exposures, and they use standard deviation to determine the possible spread of potential results. How wide are our results spread out from the mean? The probability of each outcome need not be known to calculate the standard deviation, but what you do need to know for your exam is that the greater the standard deviation, the more volatile the values are. So in other words, the higher the standard deviation, the higher the risk. The lower the standard deviation, the more likely the results will fall within a given range of the expected value. In other words, the lower the standard deviation, the lower the risk. The higher the standard deviation, the higher the risk. If there are two distributions that have the same expected value or mean, the distribution with the lower standard deviation has less risk. Let me give you an example. In the investment world, oftentimes standard deviations used to measure the risk associated with a stock. Let's say that I'm trying to pick an appropriate stock to invest in, and I've narrowed it down to stock 1 and stock 2. Both stock 1 and stock 2 have a mean return of 10%. They both have the same average return, expected value return. So stock 1 has 10% mean return, stock 2 has a 10% mean return. However, stock 1 has a standard deviation of 3%, whereas stock 2 has a standard deviation of 8%. In this case, since they both have the same mean return, we look at the stock with the lower standard deviation, in this case stock 1, to determine which stock has less risk. So if I can get a 10% average return with only a 3% standard deviation, I'd much rather have that than a 10% return with an 8% standard deviation or more risk. That's when the distributions, in this case the two stocks, have the same expected value or mean return. It's really easy in that case to see which one has more risk, right? Just the higher standard deviation. But what if they don't have the same mean return? If the two stocks had a different mean return, I could use the coefficient of variation to determine which one is more risky. So let's take a look at the coefficient of variation. The coefficient of variation compares two distributions to determine which has the greater variability relative to its expected value. The formula, which you do need to know for the exam, it's actually an easy formula. The way we calculate the coefficient of variation is we take the standard deviation and we divide that by the mean, by the average return. And essentially what that gives us is the risk per unit of return. I certainly could use coefficient of variation with my previous example, although I didn't really need to. With the previous example, since there's the same mean return, I know which one's more risky and which one's less risky, right? But let's go ahead and use the coefficient of variation just so you can see. So with stock one, my standard deviation was 3%. And the mean return was 10%. If I take 3% divided by 10%, that's 30%. My second stock had a standard deviation of 8% and a mean return of 10%. If I take 8% divided by 10%, that represents 80%, doesn't it? So stock one had a coefficient of variation of 30%. Stock two had a coefficient of variation of 80%. The higher the coefficient of variation, the greater the relative risk. So of course, in my analysis, since stock two had the higher coefficient of variation, it's got the higher relative risk. We didn't really need the coefficient of variation with that example because both stocks had the same mean return, but coefficient of variation could be a useful calculation if the stocks had a different mean rate of return. Insurers can use the coefficient of variation to determine whether a loss control measure has made losses more predictable. Another concept with respect to risk is normal distribution. A normal distribution is a bell-shaped curve probability distribution. It helps forecast volatility around a central value, and it assigns some probability for each outcome. Under a normal distribution, 68% of all outcomes are within one standard deviation of the mean. We've got 95% of outcomes are within two standard deviations of the mean, and then 99% of all outcomes are within three standard deviations of the mean. In the textbook, they use 68, 95, and 99, and those are rounded percentages. Instead of 68.26, it's fine if you just know 68%, but you want to know 68, 95, and 99. And we do have a handout called Normal Distribution, which shows a bell curve. It came with your study guide. Let's go ahead and get that out now. And it should look something like this, although in the actual handout, the percentages are not rounded, but that's okay if you just know the non-rounded percentages. So let's take a look at this. A lot of numbers here, but it's really not that difficult. We'll go through this together. If you notice in the middle here, we've got the mean. And then to the right of the mean, it says 1SD, which means one standard deviation to the right of the mean. Then we have 2SD, and then we have 3SD down here. If you look to the left of the mean, it has minus 1SD, minus 2SD, and minus 3SD. And what this normal distribution is saying is that there's a 68% probability of the actual results being within one standard deviation to the right or to the left of the mean. There's a 95% chance that the results will be within two standard deviations of the mean, and then a 99% chance that the results will be within three standard deviations of the mean. How does that all fit together? There are a couple of ways that we can use this. One way is in the world of investment. So let's go through that first, and then we'll look at losses or machine hours before a loss is expected to occur. Let's say that once again, I'm looking at buying a stock and I want to know roughly what my rate of return is going to be in the future. And so what I can do is I can use a normal distribution to predict with some probability where my return is going to fall in the future. Let's take a look. First of all, let's say that the mean return is 10%. If you remember, stock one from earlier had a mean return of 10% and a standard deviation of 3%. So if we took the 10% and put it right here in the middle where the mean is, that would be 10%. If I take the 10% and I add one standard deviation to it, and remember standard deviation is 3%, that means right here where it says 1SD, we would put 13%. Because that's a mean of 10% for the stock and a 3% standard deviation for that stock. That means that one standard deviation to the right of the mean would be 13%. What about one standard deviation left of the mean? Well, that would be 7%, wouldn't it? 10 minus 3%. So one standard deviation either way from the mean would result in either 7% on the low side, 13% on the high side. And what this normal distribution is saying is that there's a 68% probability that next year my rate of return on this particular stock will be between 7 and 13%, which is one standard deviation either way from the mean. The 68, the 95, the 99, they don't ever change. What would change is my mean return, my standard deviation. In this case, it's going to be 7% to 13%. That's one standard deviation from the mean. There's a 68% probability of that. So if I bought stock number one, I know that next year there's a 68% probability that my return will be between 7 and 13%. Let's take a look at two standard deviations now. If one standard deviation to the right is 13%, that means two standard deviations to the right would be 16%, right? 10 plus 3 plus 3. And then if you go to the left, we would have two standard deviations to the left would result in a rate of return of 4%, wouldn't it? 10 minus 3 minus 3. So for two standard deviations, the range is going to be 4 to 16%. So I can predict that next year with 95% confidence, my rate of return will be between 4 and 16%, two standard deviations from the mean. Let's take it out to 3. So we have 16% here at 2, so that would mean that three standard deviations would be 19%. And if we go three standard deviations to the left, that's going to result in 1%. 10% minus 3 minus 3 minus 3. So I know with 99% confidence that my rate of return on this stock next year will be between 1 and 19%. That is a pretty big range, but you can imagine as the standard deviation gets larger, that range gets larger too. There's more risk. So this is a way we could use standard deviation. Another way that we could use it is, let's say that we have a machine in place and the average or mean number of hours the machine can be expected to last is 8,000 hours with a standard deviation of 1,000 hours. Well, if that's the case, our mean would be 8,000 hours and the standard deviation would be 1,000. So if we're looking at one standard deviation, we take that away from the mean, that would be 7,000 to 9,000. Two standard deviations would be 6,000 to 10,000. So if we wanted, let's say, 95% certainty that we replace a machine before it fails, well, at 95%, we'd look two standard deviations and we want to go to the left, right? Because we want the minimum number of hours that it would last before it failed. So what would be with two standard deviations, we'd have 8,000 as the mean minus 1 minus 1. That would be 6,000. Two standard deviations to the left would be 6,000 hours. So if we wanted 95% confidence that we're going to replace a machine before it fails, we would replace that machine after 6,000 hours because that's two standard deviations from the mean. And that's where our 95% confidence level is. It's a lot of stuff, but hopefully, if you practice this a little bit, you should be able to get this for your exam. So let's do a couple of practice questions. An organization's operations liability losses have a severity distribution with a mean of $20,000 and a standard deviation of $30,000. What is the coefficient of variation for this distribution? And if you remember, the coefficient of variation formula is pretty straightforward. All we do is we take the standard deviation and we divide that by the mean. That gives us the risk per unit of return. If we take the standard deviation of 30,000, divide that by the mean of 20,000, that gives us 1.5. So C is our answer. A plant uses machinery to heat rubber. The life of each machine is limited, and a machine that is used for too long poses a danger of explosion. The expected life of each machine conforms to a normal distribution with a mean of 5,000 hours and a standard deviation of 300 hours. A risk manager is trying to determine when to replace a machine. He wants a less than 2% chance that a machine will become hazardous before it is replaced. When should a machine be replaced? So let's look at our numbers here. We've got a mean of 5,000 hours, and we've got a standard deviation of 300 hours. I'm going to go back to our normal distribution curve, and what we're going to want to do is put the 5,000 hours here as the mean, and then what we're looking for is a less than 2% probability, which means if we're going with 95% probability that it's not going to happen, that's still a 5% probability that we have a problem here, right? And so going with 95% is not going to work in this scenario. If we want a less than 2% probability, we're going to have to go with three standard deviations, which that's 99%, which means it's less than 2% chance of a problem occurring. So if we go with three standard deviations here, the mean is 5,000, and the standard deviation is 300 hours. So 5,000 minus 300, minus 300, and minus 300, that's 4,100. So the machine should be replaced after 4,100 hours of use. If the risk manager wants a less than 2% chance, the machine will become hazardous before it is replaced. 4,100 hours or three standard deviations is our answer. A is correct. Let's go through the concepts of value at risk and earnings at risk. Value at risk, or VAR, and earnings at risk, or EAR, these are measures that can be used to determine the likelihood of different financial outcomes. These measures help risk management professionals measure and control risk exposures. The first one, value at risk, or VAR, determines the probability of loss on an investment portfolio over a short time period. Go ahead and highlight the word loss there. Earnings at risk, or EAR, determines amount the net income of an investment may shift as a result of changes in market conditions. Let's go ahead and highlight net income. So value at risk deals with losses. Earnings at risk deals with income or earnings. Let's go through each one of these separately. And the first one is VAR, value at risk. That measures the probability of incurring a loss in value that exceeds a threshold level. What is the probability of us losing more than X dollars in a given day, with X dollars being the threshold that we've set? It quantifies the potential loss associated with an investment decision. It articulates complex positions as a single figure, and it expresses the loss in easy-to-understand monetary terms. So let's say that an organization sets a VAR loss threshold level of $200,000. So that's the threshold that's been set, $200,000. If we see a one-day 5% VAR of $200,000 on the exam, one-day 5% VAR of $200,000, let's say you see that on the exam, that means there's a 5% probability of losing $200,000 or more in one day. That's a one-day 5% VAR, and as we said, the VAR threshold was $200,000. So for the organization, it means there's only a 5% probability of losing $200,000 or more in one day. The good news is that there's a 95% probability that they'll lose less than $200,000 in one day. So that's the value at risk, and that's what it measures. There is a weakness, though, a drawback to the value at risk. The limitation is that the value at risk does not measure the extent to which a loss may exceed the threshold. In my example, we say that there was a 5% probability that a one-day loss would be $200,000 or more. But what does "or more" mean? Does that mean that our loss, if it is more than $200,000, could be $20 million? Unfortunately, the value at risk does not explain that. It does not express that. And that's a weakness of the value at risk. The good news, though, is that there is something called the conditional value at risk, and that does measure the extent to which a loss may exceed the VAR threshold. So this makes up for that weakness in the value at risk measure. It quantifies the likelihood of losing the specific dollar amount exceeding the VAR threshold. So with the VAR threshold, which in our case was $200,000, we didn't know how much larger the losses could be. The VAR didn't tell us that. CVAR does tell us the likelihood of where losses in excess of $200,000 would fall. CVAR is particularly important in fat-tailed distributions, such as hurricane risk. Those are distributions for which extremely large losses have higher probabilities than with most other probability distributions. And we also have earnings at risk. Remember, VAR deals with losses. Earnings at risk, or EAR, deals with earnings. EAR measures the likelihood earnings will be below a specific dollar amount over a specific period of time. It entails modeling the influence of factors such as changes in interest rates, sales, and costs. We use Monte Carlo simulation to calculate the earnings at risk. Monte Carlo simulation runs thousands and thousands of different options and different scenarios, modeling different changes in interest rates, sales, and costs. And then the results are presented as a probability distribution curve or as a histogram. EAR could be helpful in comparing the effects of different risk management strategies on earnings of the company. The EAR threshold is the low end of projected earnings within a specific confidence, such as 95%. So just like we had in our VAR example, a threshold of $200,000, we're also going to set a threshold with the EAR calculation. And let's say that our threshold earnings for the period of 1 year is $500,000. And we have 95% confidence. So if we say EAR is $500,000 with 95% confidence, that means that earnings for the year are projected to be $500,000 or more 95% of the time, and less than $500,000 5% of the time. That's how EAR works. So let's do a practice question. Jay has created a probability distribution for his organization that reflects a $100,000, 95% EAR for a period of 1 year. Which one of the following statements is correct? Well, we have a 95% EAR, $100,000 is the threshold, and what that means is that earnings are projected to be $100,000 or more 95% of the time. So B is our answer. Let's talk about the concept of trend analysis. Organizations use trend analysis to forecast gains and losses, and these forecasts can help risk managers make cost-effective risk management decisions for the organization. Trend analysis identifies patterns in past data and projects these patterns into the future. And trend analysis is commonly used to adjust forecasted future dollar amounts of gains or losses using an anticipated inflation rate. Let's say that 2 years ago, my organization had total hazard losses amounting to $100,000. Last year, those hazard losses were $120,000. So it went from $100,000 to $120,000. The average over the 2 years, the mean, is $110,000. But $110,000 doesn't really work as a projection for next year for a couple of reasons. Number one, maybe my production output is increasing, and that might result in more hazard losses. But number two, as costs go up, there's an inflation factor that needs to apply. So even if I had, let's say, one loss, the loss itself might be greater dollar-wise than a loss that I had last year due to inflation. So we use trend analysis to help us project what the amounts are going to be in the future. One type of trend analysis is regression analysis. Regression analysis is used to estimate a relationship or relationships between variables. It's a statistical technique, and it can increase the accuracy of forecasting. It examines relationships between the variables that affect trends. Once again, we might have a relationship between the amount of our output in our organization, the amount of production output, and the number of hazard losses. As our organization grows and we have more output, that could result in additional hazard losses. Regression analysis helps us examine those relationships. Many risks vary predictably in relation to another variable, such as, once again, the amount of production output and the number of hazard losses. There's a relationship there. And that can be forecast using a regression analysis. A specific type of regression analysis that you're responsible for on your exam is linear regression analysis. Linear regression analysis assumes that the change in the dependent variable is constant for each unit of change in the independent variable. So we have a dependent and independent variable. Let's say that over the last 3 years, we've had injuries at our plant. And let's say in year one, we had 3 injuries. In year two, we had 6 injuries. And then in year three, we had 12 injuries. If you average that out, 3 plus 6 plus 12, that's 21 injuries over 3 years. So our mean or average number of injuries is 7. But once again, we can't just say, oh, we'll have 7 injuries next year. And the reason we can't say that is because injuries have been increasing. And so what we want to do is instead use linear regression analysis to try and predict the number of injuries next year. In order to do that, we need a dependent variable and an independent variable. The dependent variable is the variable being forecasted. For example, injuries. The number of injuries is the dependent variable. And that would be charted on the vertical or y-axis. We'll look at that in just a second. The independent variable is the variable that determines the value of the dependent variable. In this case, the independent variable would be the year we're looking at. If we want to project out injuries for 10 years, the independent variable would be 10, because that's the number of years we're looking forward. The independent variable is charted on the horizontal axis, which is the x-axis. If you note here, the horizontal axis is the x-axis, and this is where we would have the independent variable. Now, in this example, we have 0, 0.5, 1, 1.5, and 2. That could be, for example, every half year, every 6 months, or we can make this every year if we wanted to. Regardless of what we choose for our x-axis, for our independent variable, the dependent variable, which would be the number of injuries, is charted on the y-axis, which is the vertical axis. And as you can see, what's happening is we're trying to establish some type of linear relationship that shows how many injuries we're going to have in the future. You'll notice that it's represented by a straight line. Linear regression analysis results in a straight line, either increasing or decreasing. In this case, it will be increasing. But the reality is, the future is not going to give us a straight line of injuries. If you notice the dots, there is 1 year where the dot is below the line, 1 year where the dot is above the line. But what we're trying to do is predict the future and predict a linear relationship going forward. So once again, our dependent variable, which is injuries or losses, is on the y-axis. And our independent variable, which could be years or hours, that would be on the x-axis here, which is the horizontal axis. So let's go through the calculation of linear regression analysis. In other words, how do we determine the slope of that line? How do we calculate how many losses or injuries we're going to have in the future? There's a formula. The slope of the line, which is m, is the amount by which y increases or decreases with a 1 unit increase along the x-axis. For example, maybe we have, with each additional year that we add onto our analysis, we're going to have 5 more injuries or 5.7 more injuries. And so y would increase by, let's say, 5.7 injuries with a 1 year increase along the x-axis. So with that, that's m. M is going to be in our formula here. We'll come back to that in a second. M is the slope of the line. The y-intercept, which is b in this equation, is the point at which the line crosses the y-axis. In other words, it's our starting point. I'm going to go back here. If you notice here on the y-axis, it looks like we have roughly 40 losses because the first point of data here on this y-axis is 50, and our line touches the y-axis slightly below that 50. So our starting point, which in our equation is going to be b, in this case looks to be about 40. And so they'll give you on the exam, they'll give you the starting point. That starting point is called the y-intercept. It's where our line connects to the y-axis. That's the point at which the line crosses the y-axis. And when x equals 0, we're going to have a value of y. So in this case, in the previous slide, if x was 0, y would be roughly 40. It looked like it was about 40. The equation of the line is y equals m times x plus b. So what it essentially means is that our slope of the line, which would be, let's say, 5.7 injuries, would be multiplied by the year we're looking at. Let's say we're looking 10 years in the future, so we'd multiply that by 10, but we have to add in our initial amount at time 0, which is the b. So let's go through an example. Let's say that we have someone who owns currently 25 taxis, and he wants to add 90 taxis to his fleet this year. So what's the dependent variable? The dependent variable would be the losses incurred, the auto accidents, for example. The independent variable would be the number of taxis in the fleet. So let's go back once again. The x-axis would be the number of taxis. The y-axis would be the number of losses. So let's say that our starting point is 4 losses. With an existing 25 taxi fleet, there are 4 losses. That would be our B, wouldn't it? 4 losses. That's initially what we're starting with the existing fleet. If we add in 90 more taxis, well, we have to look and see what the slope is. What is the slope? And they'll give you that on the exam. The slope is M. So let's say that it's 0.1, 0.1, 10% roughly. So if we add 90 taxis, we would take 0.1 times 90, which of course is 9, and then we would add in our starting point, which is B, which I said was 4. That means that we would have projected amount of 13 losses. If we have 25 taxis now, if this person wants to add in 90 more taxis and the slope is 0.1, that person can expect to have 13 losses. It's m times x, and the m in this case was 0.1, the slope. The x in this case was 90 new taxis, and we add in b, which was the initial amount, 4, that equals 13. This line becomes less accurate the farther away it gets from the actual data values used. Makes sense. We are predicting the future. The further we go, the more likely we are to be off in our estimate. So let's do a practice question. A manufacturing company is estimating the number of expected workers' compensation claims using regression analysis. The company has assumed the following. The y-intercept, dependent variable, equals 3. So the y-intercept, this is going to be the b in the equation, that equals 3. The slope coefficient is 1.5. And the number of payroll hours in thousands is 70. Approximately how many workers' compensation claims should be expected next year? So let's take a look. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the slope of the line, which is 1.5. We multiply it by the number of payroll hours in thousands. So 1.5 times 70 is 105. And then, of course, you have to add in the B, which is 3. So we add 105 plus 3, and that equals 108. So C is our answer. Let's wrap up Module 9 by talking about the analysis of event consequences. We can use decision trees and event trees to predict the likelihood and consequences arising from decisions or events. So let's go through both of those. We'll start with decision tree analysis. Decision tree analysis examines consequences of decisions, and that includes both the costs and the gains associated with decisions. So what we're doing with decision tree analysis is we're looking at decisions and trying to decide what the possible gains or costs will be. It can help reduce the uncertainty involved in decision making. A decision tree compares different decisions, and it allows us to select the one that is most likely going to help us achieve our goals. Decision tree analysis can often provide both qualitative and quantitative analysis. Qualitative generates scenarios and consequences resulting from a decision, and quantitative estimate the probabilities of scenarios resulting from a decision. So we look at the different decisions and the possible results of the decisions, and then we assign probabilities to those results to try and make the best choice. Constructing the decision tree begins with identifying the decision under consideration. For example, we might have a decision under consideration to either invest in a new product or not invest in a new product. So our starting point is determining what that decision is, investing or not investing. Then various sequences of events or pathways are charted for each potential decision. So for example, with the decision to either invest in a new product or not invest in a new product, we really only have two paths, don't we? Investing or not investing. Each pathway leads to an outcome. For example, if we choose to invest, then we have, let's say, three potential outcomes of that decision. We have a great outcome, a good outcome, or a poor outcome. And what we would do is we take those three outcomes and we'd assign probabilities. Probabilities are assigned to each pathway, and expected values of each pathway can be estimated. So let's say with the decision to invest in the new product, we've got a great, good, and poor outcome that's a possibility. Well, then we'll assign a probability. Let's say that there's a 50% probability of a great outcome, a 30% probability of a good outcome, and a 20% probability of a poor outcome. We'd show that on the decision tree. The pathway that produces the highest expected value can then be determined, and we'll select whichever path produces the highest expected value. A decision tree is a way of looking at different decisions. We also have event trees, which are very similar to decision trees, except with event trees, we're looking at the potential consequences of events, not necessarily looking at consequences of decisions. Event tree analysis analyzes various pathways, just like decision trees. However, event trees analyze consequences of accidental events rather than looking at decisions. Event tree analysis examines all possible consequences of an accidental event, their probabilities, and existing measures to prevent or control them. It's often used to examine the effectiveness of risk treatment methods. So instead of looking at decisions, we're looking at the consequences of accidental events. Event tree analysis can provide both qualitative and quantitative analysis, just like decision tree analysis. Qualitative can help generate scenarios, progressions, and consequences that could result from an accidental event. Quantitative can estimate probabilities and frequencies of various scenarios and outcomes. When creating an event tree analysis, there are several steps involved. The first step is to identify the first accidental event that could result in unwanted consequences, the first significant unwanted departure from a normal series of events. For example, an initiation event could be a hole forming in a chemical storage tank over a 5-year period. So a hole forming could be the initiation event. Next, we identify the various progressions of events that could follow the accidental event. This could include any barriers to those consequences, could be based on factors such as human responses or interaction with other systems. The analysis ends with a list of potential consequences of the initial event. In each pathway, every barrier has a potential to either function or fail, so each pathway is going to split into two. And then probabilities are assigned. We do have a handout that came with your study materials of the event tree. It shows an event tree. And if you look at the top, it says along the top, initiation event, fire origin, sprinkler broken, and so forth. And so the initial item here is initiation event, which is an explosion. We then have pathways leading from the initiation event. And if you notice, each pathway has a true option and a false option. So for example, if we have an explosion, that may lead to a fire. So we have true, it leads to a fire. False, it doesn't lead to a fire. And if you notice, we've assigned probabilities. So if we have an explosion, there's an 80% chance that that's going to lead to a fire, and there's a 20% chance it will not. If it does lead to a fire, then what could happen in that scenario? Well, our sprinkler system could be broken, and so we have true and false associated with the fire origin pathway. So let's say that if we do have a fire, there's a 10% chance our sprinkler system will be broken, a 90% chance it will not be broken. And let's say that the sprinkler is broken, well then what could happen? The alarm system could fail to activate. And let's say that there's a 5% chance that the alarm system will not activate, a 95% chance that that's false, in other words, the alarm will activate, and then that leads us to our final outcome. So if you look all the way up the path of all of the trues, we have a non-controlled fire without an alarm system. That is the worst case scenario. And what we can do then is determine the probability of that. And to determine the probability, we take all the probabilities along that path and multiply them by each other. So for example, a fire resulting from an explosion is 80%. The sprinkler being broken is 10%. The alarm not activated is 5%. If I take 80%, times 10% times 5%, that's a 0.004 probability of that worst case scenario happening. If you look for the explosion not leading to a fire, that's just purely 20%, right? So that's 20% probability. But let's look at another scenario. Let's say we have an explosion that does lead to a fire. The sprinkler system is not broken. The sprinkler system works, but the alarm is not activated. In that case, we have a controlled fire without an alarm. That's a 0.3036 probability. And so that's the event tree. End probability represents the likelihood that every event in the pathway will occur. In other words, if you added up all these annual frequencies, you would get a result of 1. So every possibility has been taken into account here. Like a decision tree, an event tree creates a visual portrayal of sequences and outcomes. It illustrates the potential effectiveness of control systems following accidental events. We just went through the different paths. One limitation, though, is that it typically provides only 2 options, success or failure. In other words, true or false. It fails to reflect the complexity of some processes or products. So let's do a practice question. A chemical company stores chemicals in a large underground storage tank. Their risk manager, John, is concerned that a leak could form in the tank. To analyze this risk, he constructed an event tree. He believes there's a 30% chance there will be a leak in the tank in the next 3 years, and if a leak occurs, he believes there's a 10% chance the existing leakage barrier will not contain the leak. If the barrier does not contain the leak, he believes there's a 60% chance of severe pollution and a 40% chance of minor pollution. What is the probability of severe pollution from the tank occurring in the next 3 years. And what we're going to do is multiply the appropriate probabilities times each other to get the result. So we start off and there's a 30% chance there will be a leak. So we take 30%, and if the leak occurs, there's a 10% chance the existing leakage barrier will not contain the leak. So we take 30% times 10%, and if the barrier does not contain the leak, he believes there's a 60% chance of severe pollution, which is what this question is asking us for. So we're going to take 30% times 10% times 60%. We don't care about the 40% here because we're not looking for minor pollution. We're looking for the probability of severe pollution. If we take 30 times 10 times 60, that equals 1.8% probability. So B is our answer, and that concludes Module 9.